Thank you for listening to Remnant Bible Fellowship. This is Brother Jonathan. Today we're going to be talking about the resurrection of Christ. I do apologize if my voice sounds a little strange. I've been sick for about a week or two, and so it's been real hard for me to do any recording because my voice has been all over the place. Some days I haven't been able to talk at all, so that's why if my voice sounds a little strange today. But this is a very basic episode, and I'm going to repeat things that I've done in the episodes an episode on defending the resurrection of Jesus, which was a pretty deep subject. We went into historiography and apologetics and those things, so that's not exactly an introductory episode, but I had to repeat some things from it that I think everybody can wrap their head around, because there's certain questions, as the resurrection of Christ is a very attacked doctrine and teaching of Christianity, but a necessary one, because if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then there is absolutely no validity to Christianity. So I do repeat a couple things from that, but nothing I think that is going to be over people's heads if they listen and just take in what we're talking about. And there's going to be some very basic, simple things we're going to be talking about also. But if you want a more detailed look at the apologetics for defending the resurrection of Jesus, then you should go listen to that episode, Defending the Resurrection of Jesus. I wanted to not go super in-depth about that here, but there are questions that get raised sometimes that make it unavoidable to deal with, like I said, so I had to repeat some things. There's no harm in hearing it again if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, because that was, I think, last year. So I would recommend that you read Gary Habermas and Michael Lacona's book, The Case for the Resurrection, if you want to study the subject, though. It's very basic and on a level that a non-scholar can grasp easily. And obviously there's some deeper works if you are a more academically minded person, like Michael Lacona's dissertation that he did on the resurrection of Jesus, a historiographical approach, which you can get from, I think, Academia Press and things like that. But obviously the first point about that we want to talk about the resurrection and going through this series on basic doctrinal points is that Jesus foretold his resurrection. He knew he was going to die, and he knew that he was going to rise again. It was a complete fulfillment of the Old Testament prophets and everything that the Old Testament was ultimately leading up to. We read it in Mark chapter 8, verse 31. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. That's Mark chapter 8, verse 31. Now, there are significant things in the context of this passage just supported as being authentic to the words of Christ. And I say that not to cast doubt on any of the scriptures and stuff, but taking some of this from the episode on defending the resurrection of Jesus, where if you use the absolute most skeptical criteria of looking at the scriptures, you can defend the resurrection of Jesus and treat it as a historical event. So don't think that I'm in any way looking down on the scriptures or anything like that. But just if you take the most skeptical and scholarly views of the scriptures, honestly, you still can look at it as reliable, as being legitimately reliable. But the term the Son of Man, though it's used over 80 times in reference to Christ in the Gospels, seems like it was one of his favorite ways to refer to himself, was not used by the early Christians later, that is after the apostles, to refer to him. Critics call this the principle of dissimilarity, and it's one of the most skeptical criteria that they use to judge the scriptures. And this passage passes the test. So even under the most skeptical criteria from scholars, this passage passes the test as being legitimately the words of Christ. It means that this statement is most likely not something that was added after the fact by Christians, because it uses a title for Christ that the early Christians didn't. And also, this statement is repeated in the parallel passages in Matthew chapter 16, verse 21 through 23, and Luke chapter 9, verse 22. Those two passages contain Semitic elements in the language that Mark does not include. This shows that multiple sources were most likely used to verify this quote from Christ. They didn't just copy this passage from one another. And this is the critical criteria called multiple attestation. That means it was verified by more than one source by the writer of this gospel. And lastly, there are two rebukes in the context of this verse that would have been greatly embarrassed that would have greatly embarrassed the early Christians. The first being that Peter, who would become a leader in the early church, rebuked Jesus for saying that he would die. Remember where he says, you know, surely this isn't going to happen to you. And Christ tells him, says, you know, get thee behind me, Satan. And so the entire point of Christianity is that Jesus died and rose again. And so you have Peter here in the context saying, no, that's not going to happen. And so it's very embarrassing to early Christianity that they recorded those things, which points to it being authentic. The second point regarding that being that Christ in turn rebuked Peter for rebuking him about it. So Peter questions Christ, which is embarrassing to Christianity, and then Christ rebukes Peter, who would be a leader in Christianity, the early church. And so both of those things are embarrassing out of this passage, which shows that it's most likely authentic. Nobody intentionally opens themselves up to attack by their critics, which, you know, is something that shows that this is a valid, authentic, you know, statement from Christ. As for the example, it's like if it had been made up, such as some people claim the Gospels are, these types of things would have hurt the cause of Christianity and been a source of embarrassment. Therefore, it's most likely true. That's called the principle of embarrassment. If somebody wants to say that the Gospels were made up or written by a 3rd or 4th century monk, as a lot of ignorant people try to say sometimes, if it was a made up religion, why would they include a whole bunch of things that would embarrass them? And that they would not be able really to do a very good job of defending themselves against. These things actually happened. The Bible records truth, true events as they happened. And so it just, it's the principle of embarrassment. But another passage that Christ foretold his, you know, resurrection, it's reliable in the sense of even in the scholarly community, and is Mark chapter 9, verse 31, where we read, "For he taught his disciples and said unto them, The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of men, and they shall kill him, and after that he is killed, he shall rise the third day." Now, many scholars hold that this passage may be quite early because the language used shows an Aramaic influence. Aramaic was a language that the Jews commonly spoke at this time. So anywhere in the Gospels where Aramaic is used or insinuated, such as the place where it's recorded that Christ says, Talitha kumai, it's believed to predate the text of the gospel and be original. And because it was the common spoken language by Jews in the first century, Aramaic, their ancestors had learned it when they were in Babylon hundreds of years before. And also Jesus is also referred to as the Son of Man in this passage. So this passage, therefore, is supported by early attestation and dissimilarity, you know. Thirdly, Jesus' Last Supper statements about his body being broken and his blood being shed, as found in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 24 through 25, where it's quoted by Paul, and Luke chapter 22, verses 15 through 20, support Christ's claim for vindication after his resurrection. Both Luke 22, 20 and 1 Corinthians 11, 25, appearing nearly identical, shows that they most likely draw from some independent source predating them both. A lot of scholars believe that there was an oral Jesus tradition. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, we think today that oral history is very badly preserved. Not so much back in those days because they were an oral culture. But things were written down very early on, even within the life of the witnesses, very, very early on, especially in 1 Corinthians 15. But his language in Mark 14:25 implies that he expected to be raised and vindicated, but he goes on to directly state that he would rise from the dead in verse 28. And this text is supported, therefore, by multiple attestation, multiple sources, early attestation, that's a very early witness, and dissimilarity, that there is multiple sources, you know, and they don't necessarily record verbatim the same exact thing. Fourthly, we see in Jesus' prayer and conversation with his disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane that he was expecting a violent death. This is shown in Mark chapter 14, verses 32 through 41, Matthew chapter 26, verse 36 through 45, and Luke 22, verse 39 through 46. And so the fact that Jesus showed fear and apprehension about facing death actually bears witness to its truthfulness. Jewish writings were filled with examples of people dying martyrs' deaths with great bravery, however manufactured some of them may be. Even the early church had the record of Stephen's stoning, where he showed no fear. So the fact that Jesus showed fear and apprehension was quite embarrassing to early Christianity. So if the claims for Jesus' divinity were made up to support an idea for a new religion that the disciples were simply pushing, then why would they make their Savior appear to be afraid and apprehensive? This embarrassing inclusion shows that it is most likely true. And these statements are therefore supported by the principle of embarrassment. Also, it's supported by multiple attestation. And there's nothing wrong with thinking about that. Christ had to go through a death in the sense of a spiritual side of things, very different than any other man ever will. It wasn't just physical things. There was a lot of things playing into it that made Jesus' death very, very unique. And so there's a lot of factors that go into it that none of us can ever sympathize with. Now, there are other texts that can be used, but these are the texts that have the supporting evidence of historicity by the standards of critical scholarship, meaning that those people who are very skeptical of the text of Scripture. And so the fact that these claims have such support also greatly raises the probability of the many others as being reliable also. And so what should be remembered when considering the fact that Christ predicted his own death and resurrection is that the disciples were not convinced of his resurrection because he predicted it. On the contrary, they continued to misunderstand his prediction and not believe it. You read Mark chapter 8, verse 31 through 33, chapter 9, verse 31 through 32, chapter 14, verse 27 through 31, Luke chapter 24, verses 13 through 24. Even when people claimed to have seen him raised and went to see the empty tomb, the disciples continued to still not believe. John chapter 20, verse 2, verse 13 through 15, Luke chapter 24, verses 10 through 12, and John chapter 20, verses 24 through 25. So the question that should be on your mind is, what then caused them to believe it? And so you have to think about that whenever people are questioning you about the resurrection. It wasn't, and I know we always point to the empty tomb, and that's still valid on a certain level. It's still an argument for the fact that Jesus did rise from the dead. But you have to remember that even the empty tomb did not convince the disciples that Jesus rose from the dead. That's what the scriptures record. It was the fact that they saw and touched Christ himself. They saw and touched the wounds in his hands and in his side. They saw him eat in their presence. And so you always have to remember that when considering the resurrection of Christ. We're not talking about the empty tomb only, or the fact that he predicted it, and just be like, well, he said he would, so therefore we believe it. Well, and yes, there is a sense as Christians, if God says something, we believe it. The fact is, he proved it. He showed up. It wasn't just that they saw an empty tomb and was like, oh, he must have rose from the dead, because that opens you up to a lot of counter arguments that are valid. So let's go over, there's a lot of confusion, and I understand it, about the how do we harmonize the different accounts of the resurrection of Christ in the different passages, Mark 16, Luke 24, John chapter 20, and Matthew chapter 28, because they don't seem at first to line up. And there's some things that you have to remember about how historically people in that time, in the first century, recorded history. It was very different than today. They saw fit to leave certain things out. Sometimes they even saw fit in certain instances to rearrange chronological order. Everything was geared towards a specific audience. There was things emphasized over other things. And so if something didn't seem to matter to that person who was recording it, they would leave it out. There would be multiple people in a group and they would not mention the people who had nothing to do with the situation. And so you have to think about that. And we'll talk about more of that in a minute. And so what we're going to go over real quick is a harmonization of the resurrection morning. When you put all the passages together, you look at the so-called contradictions, you look at the so-called inconsistencies, and you lay them all out. It does make sense. It makes complete sense. And so I'm just going to read through what I truly believe is the harmonizing of resurrection morning. And this is, there are a lot of good places where you can get lists like this, ministry-wise. So first, a group of women began to go to the tomb to finish the burial custom for Jesus' body. One thing you have to understand about that, if people say, well, what in the world were they doing? Well, whenever Joseph and Nicodemus, we assume that it was both of them together working on it. It was Joseph's tomb, and Nicodemus is said to have brought the things to anoint his body for the burial and stuff. It was a very hasty thing that was done because it was approaching the Sabbath and it was late in the day. And so while they did enough to do a basic job of preserving the body, it was not the final thing as the Jews did for their burial custom. So what the women were doing was going to come, and since they had seen with their eyes where he was buried, it specifically states that. And I doubt that women who were following him, who followed him and were wholly devoted to him, would ever go to the wrong tomb. It's just such a nonsensical argument, especially when one of them was his mother in a certain time. And so they were going to go and finish the burial custom for Jesus' body, what we call, you know, we think of today as embalming the body. So that's what they were going to do. And they actually were questioning themselves, okay, how are we going to get the stone rolled away? Now, Mary Magdalene seems to have gone on ahead and while it was still dark. And there's several different ways that this could be explained, because if all the women left together and then they were questioning about themselves, saying, okay, well, how are we going to get this stone out of the way? They could have been, oh, Mary, can you go ahead and see what we can do about it, or see if there's still anybody there who can help us? There's all sorts of reasons for Mary going on by herself. But what we do know is she seems to have been the first one there. Next, what we read is, supposedly, before Mary actually got there, the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and rolled away the stone from the tomb. This frightened the guards who were watching the tomb, and they most likely passed out because the scripture says they became as dead men, or like dead. And so most likely what happened is they passed out, which is understandable if you saw an angel of the Lord descend from heaven and roll away the stone from a dead man's tomb, which you are supposed to be the one guarding. And so Mary Magdalene arrives and finds the tomb open and empty. And so she goes to tell Peter and John that they have stolen the Lord's body, thinking that the body was stolen. The other women arrived after Mary seems to have left around sunrise, right at the breaking of dawn, and looked into the tomb because they came and it was already open. And they see the two angels sitting. Now, Matthew and Mark only mention one angel because only one spoke. And that makes complete sense. That is completely in alignment with how history was written at the time, how Greco-Roman bios and those things were recorded at the time. Similar as in the instance whenever the disciples and Jesus go across the Sea of Galilee and there's a demoniac of Gadara. But in one place it says there was two. Well, why would they say there's only one? Now, we'll actually talk about that here in a little bit too. That's not a contradiction by definition. It's not a contradiction. And I'll explain why. And so they only mention one because only one of the angels spoke. Now, the angel who spoke told them to go to tell the disciples that Jesus was risen and would see them in Galilee. The women obeyed, it says in Matthew chapter 28, verses 8 through 10. And they were very afraid, we read from Mark chapter 16, verse 8. Now, Peter and John, being retrieved by Mary Magdalene by this time, they run to the tomb and see that it is empty. And Mary comes with them. And so they believe that his body was stolen, and they leave. And they leave while Mary stays behind weeping at the tomb. Now Mary Magdalene looks into the tomb now and sees the two angels. And then she sees Jesus and doesn't initially recognize him. Remember, she's weeping. And so after he says her name, she recognizes him. And he tells her to go to tell the disciples that he has risen. And she obeys. We read in John chapter 20, verses 17 through 18. Mary Magdalene tells the disciples, and they don't believe her. The other women, while on their way, are met by Jesus. And it's likely that he appeared to them at that time because of how afraid they were. Remember, it says very specifically that they were afraid, and they were in one place it says they were afraid and didn't tell anybody. And so at this point, this seems to be whenever Christ appeared to them. Now, after seeing him, they go and tell the disciples joyfully that they had seen him risen from the dead. That's Luke 24, 9 through 11. But by this time, the 11 disciples and all the rest had heard from all the women, including Mary Magdalene, and still did not believe. Now, during the day, Jesus later appears to the two disciples who were on their way to Emmaus. They returned to Jerusalem to tell the other disciples and are informed that Christ had appeared already to Simon Peter. Now, we don't get much detail about him appearing to Peter, but it is corroborated by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 5. It's just something that we are not told specifically about. And it may be because of Peter's denial. that Christ specifically saw Peter by himself. Now, it's said in Luke chapter 24, verse 33, that their two disciples found the 11 gathered together. Now, Jesus then appears to them, but in John chapter 20, verse 24, we're told that Thomas wasn't with them. And this is most likely an instance of synecdoche. Synecdoche is a figure of speech where a part of something is referred to as the whole, or vice versa. It's like saying Germany invaded France. Well, the entire country of Germany did not literally walk into France to fight. No, certain soldiers of the German army were sent to invade France. We understand that. And so the phrase, the 11, most likely referred to the group of disciples known as the apostles. And it's also possible that Thomas left before Christ appeared. And one of the reasons I've heard speculated, which would make sense, is because Thomas was worried about his twin brother. Thomas, the word Thomas means twin. Thomas could have been worried about his twin brother being arrested, being mistaken for him, because his given name in John chapter 20, verse 24, is Thomas called Didymus. And the word Didymus means the twin in Greek. So either of these explains the text. The fact that Thomas left before Christ appeared, which would happen, you know, people didn't just sit around all day long doing nothing. Or that it's just synecdoche. Either of those explains this. Now, Jesus proceeds to eat in their presence and invites them to touch his resurrection body for them to see that it was physical. And so Christ, he does a double aspect there of showing them, no, I am physically resurrected from the dead, because they touched him and they saw him eat food in their presence. Now, in John chapter 21 and Matthew chapter 28, verse 16 through 17, they both record later appearances by Christ to the disciples. Also, Jesus appeared to Saul of Tarsus when he was traveling to Damascus in Acts chapter 9, albeit this was most likely not a physical post-resurrection appearance. At some point, also, James, the half-brother of Jesus, saw the risen Lord also. This is recorded in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 7. Now, in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul states what is believed to be an early Christian creed by scholars. Scholars are beginning to recognize some places in the New Testament that seem to reference these creeds or early Christian hymns, because of the peculiar cadence and style of the Greek in these places. But that passage in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 8 says, "For I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received, how that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he was seen of Cephas," which is an Aramaic name for Saint Peter, "and then of the 12. After that he was seen of above 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain unto the present, but some are fallen asleep. After that he was seen of James, then of all the apostles, and last of all he was seen of me also, as of one born out of due time." And so it's believed by some that the appearance to over 500 disciples at once was on a mountain in Galilee. And we may conclude this list of appearances by reminding ourselves of what Luke said whenever in the beginning of the book of Acts, where he says, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, "The former treatise have I made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began both to do and teach, until the day in which he was taken up. After that he, through the Holy Ghost, had given commandments unto the apostles whom he had chosen, to whom also he showed himself alive after his passion by many infallible proofs, being seen of them 40 days, and speaking of the things pertaining to the kingdom of God, and being assembled together with them, commanded them that they should not depart from Jerusalem, but wait for the promise of the Father, which saith he, ye have heard of me." So Luke states that Christ had appeared to them after his death, or his passion, by many infallible proofs, even for 40 days. So Luke also records that the disciples, probably not just the 11 disciples called apostles, but the general group of the disciples, saw Jesus physically ascend to heaven. Now, let me move on to talk about supposed contradictions for a minute. Now, I strongly recommend Jason Lyle's book, Keeping Faith in an Age of Reason. I think it's the best book on supposed Bible contradictions that I've ever come across. He's thorough and doesn't compromise the text to give answers. He also uses logic, as Jason Lyle normally does in everything he writes. And so I was originally going to go over some supposed contradictions in the resurrection accounts from the Gospels, but I decided against it. Firstly, because I don't want to discourage people who might not have a deep enough knowledge of the scriptures by going into logical fallacies and stuff. I may in the future, if requested, do a whole episode on this topic, but I don't believe it's necessary right now in this series. Suffice to say, about the matter that most so-called quote-unquote Bible contradictions don't even meet the definition of the word contradiction. And let me take a minute to explain what I mean by that. See, a contradiction occurs when two statements cannot be simultaneously true. So if I was to say, all S are P, and some S are not P, then I've made a contradiction. If all S are P, then it is impossible that some S are not P. Now, this becomes clear when we plug terms in for the symbols S and P. If I said, all Snickers are candy bars, and some Snickers are not candy bars, that's a contradiction. Both of those statements cannot simultaneously be true. If all Snickers are candy bars, then it is impossible that some of them are not. That's a contradiction. And most of the time, though, when someone claims that the Bible is full of contradictions, they don't know the definition of the word. So ask them to explain to you what a contradiction is. And they'll probably say something like along the lines of that when two statements are different, then they are contradictory. Well, yes, that might be, but different does not mean contradictory. It could be complementary, two sides of the same thing, all sorts of things like that. A common example that is brought up, like I mentioned earlier, is how many angels did the women see when they were at the tomb of Jesus? One or two? If I said I saw two cars today, would I be incorrect if I then said that I saw one car? Well, actually, no. One is part of two. There's no contradiction. If I saw two cars, then I necessarily saw one car, because two ones equals two, if you follow what I'm saying. In fact, I saw two sets of one car. So this supposed quote-unquote Bible contradiction is what's called a subset fallacy. One is part of two. You know, one plus one equals two. So if I saw two, I necessarily saw one. That's not a contradiction. Just the one author is emphasizing one, the one person who's speaking, not the two that were there. There's all sorts of situations that you can think of in everyday life where we do this. If somebody comes over to your house, they bring two friends, and they talk to you about something, and then they left with their friends. And you told somebody later saying, hey, Joe came and talked to me today. Well, did you lie? Did you contradict yourself? No, you were emphasizing that the one person, the conversation you had, that's what you were emphasizing. Now, it would be very different if somebody said, I saw only one car today. But that's not ever said like that in the sense of this quote-unquote Bible contradiction and in many other places in the New Testament and in the Old Testament. This is just a failure to honestly think is really what it is. Sometimes amongst the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, one of the evangelists says one person or angel and the other says two. Which is it? Both. If only one person spoke, then why mention the other one? But people forget that the way that Greco-Roman bios, which is the genre that the Gospels were written in, and histories written by people such as like Plutarch back in the day, were written back in the day was not like how we do it today. They did leave things out and shift around events chronologically and such things to suit their needs. Not to change it, but just to emphasize certain things and make it more streamlined for the purpose for which they were writing. They did emphasize things more than others sometimes, depending on who they were writing for. And this is how many supposed Bible contradictions are claimed for the New Testament. People not understanding the context, not reading the text carefully, not even thinking, all sorts of incidences like that. And so in addition to that, many times people will read, for example, passages and take them out of context, claiming a contradiction. And this would be like me picking up a book about Sally, who had red hair in chapter 1, and turning to chapter 5, where she has blonde hair, and claiming that the author is a dunce because of so obvious an error. When I would be the real fool because I didn't read chapter 3 and read where it says that she died a blonde. And this is how most people handle the Bible. They're not looking for truth. They're looking for any excuse to toss it aside. Their motto is, I'll believe anything but Jesus. So professing themselves to be wise, they will commit themselves to foolishness is really what it is. And so if you're a young Christian especially, I've yet to find a supposed contradiction in the text that is not explained by logic, textual transmission, or translation procedure. But like I said, I don't want to belabor the point now. If somebody has questions about those sorts of things, just send me a message and request, and maybe I'll do a whole episode on quote-unquote Bible contradictions. But let me just consider one or two questions about the resurrection of Christ, which is a pretty straightforward topic. Jesus rose from the dead. And because I've done other episodes on this, I don't want to go too in-depth on it right now. But one question is, was Jesus' resurrection body a physical body? Some people try to say he rose spiritually. Well, that's completely contrary to the text of Scripture. It's contrary to church history. It's contrary to the eyewitness accounts. It's contrary to everything. Because if you read the Scriptures just plainly, you see that it was physical, and the apostles took it as physical. And they're the only ones who really have authority to tell us. Now, if you read in Luke chapter 24, verses 36 through 43, it says, And as they thus spake, Jesus himself stood in the midst of them, and saith unto them, Peace be unto you. But they were terrified and affrighted, and supposed that they had seen a spirit. And he said unto them, Why are ye troubled? And why do thoughts arise in your hearts? Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see. For a spirit hath not flesh and bones, as ye see me have. And when he had thus spoken, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they yet believed not for joy, and wondered, he said unto them, Have ye here any meat? And they gave him a piece of a broiled fish, and an honeycomb. And he took it, and did eat before them. So there is no room in Christianity for the Greek philosophical idea, which has really permeated modern thought in some levels, that the physical is evil, and spirit is always good. And this has permeated several religions in the world today. And that's the notion that the physical universe is a limitation that the spirit must escape. It's a Gnostic idea and not a Christian one. When Jesus rose from the dead, he went out of his way to show them that he had a physical body. And the disciples touched him and he ate food in their presence. Now, the difference between that body is that it was not a carnal body. It was not a sinful body or anything like that. It was, as Paul states in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 42 through 47, he says, So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body, and there is a spiritual body. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, was made a living soul. The last Adam, referencing Christ, was made a quickening spirit. Quickening being an older way of saying a living. Howbeit, that was not first which is spiritual, but that which is natural, and afterward that which is spiritual. The first man is of the earth, earthy. The second man is the Lord from heaven. So Jesus was resurrected with a physical and yet spiritual body. There was a change in his body, and we'll see what that means in just a minute. Another question is, what does this mean for believers' resurrection? Because one of the key aspects of Christianity is not that Jesus rose from the dead only, but the fact that because he rose from the dead, so shall those who are his. It gives us a pattern for what believers' resurrection will be like. That's what Jesus' resurrection does. His resurrection body is what ours will be like. Paul very clearly stated this in Philippians chapter 3, verse 20 through 21, where he says, For our conversation is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. So when we are physically born, we bear the image of Adam, you know, physical and mortality. And when we are born again, we are molded into the image of Christ gradually over our lifetimes by our behavior. We're born again and we begin to follow after the pattern of Christ. And at the resurrection of believers after the Lord's return, we will see the fulfillment of this. This is the already but not yet principle of the scriptures. Christ has already purchased these things, and so they are as good as done, but the total fulfillment and manifestation of them has not yet come. We see this kind of principle in the New Testament. Here's a couple of verses. 1 Corinthians 15:49. And as we have borne the image of the earthy, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly. 1 John 3:2. Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You see the already but not yet in that verse. Romans chapter 8, verse 11. But if the spirit of him that raised up Jesus from the dead dwell in you, he that raised up Christ from the dead shall also quicken your mortal bodies by his spirit that dwelleth in you. It's Romans chapter 8, verse 11. So let's just look at two or three things real quick that show us the significance of the resurrection of Christ. It's the unquestionable proof of Christ's deity. It was the thing that God had determined to show forth that this is his Son, and it is in him that salvation lies. Next, it's the unquestionable proof of the Christian faith. If you are a young Christian or you're somebody who's getting into studying apologetics, the thing that you need to, if you ever look at how other religions defend themselves, Christianity is very unique. There is no other religion or philosophical system in existence that defends itself the way Christianity does, because we appeal to fact and we appeal to science. We appeal to reason and logic. There is no other system in the world that does that. Islam does not defend itself that way. Mormons don't defend themselves that way. Jehovah's Witnesses don't defend themselves that way. Hindus, I don't really see how they can defend themselves at all. But Christianity comes down to the fact that God himself became a man, entered into history, and did this thing that nobody has been able to disprove. In fact, all the proof lies on one side, which we'll look at in a minute. And so Christianity, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, there is no such thing as Christianity. And so that's the third thing. It is the proof of his redemption. Because Christ rose from the dead, it validated all that the scriptures have to say regarding salvation. And really almost every other doctrine in Christianity, it always finds itself somehow connected to what Christ has accomplished, because he is the cornerstone of the Christian faith. He is the linchpin of everything in Christianity. And so in that sense, you can look at it as the resurrection of Christ shows the validity of every single promise that God has made to those of us who would commit ourselves to him. Now, I do want to take a minute, and I did copy this from the Defending the Resurrection of Jesus episode, but because it constantly comes up about these quote-unquote arguments against the resurrection, because if you don't take time to examine them, you don't take time to examine things, to some people they sound pretty convincing. And so I want to look at them for a minute. And there are certain facts that theories about Jesus' resurrection, these theories must account for. They must explain, because they are so well attested by history and by just fact. That's really what they are. Even people who are not scholars, who are not Christians, call these things facts. There are four minimal facts that enjoy almost unanimous support from scholars who study the subject of history. And people, I'm not even talking about Christian scholars, I'm talking about scholars in general, people who actually know the field of history or historiography, they see these things as fact. And there's one fact that enjoys about 75% of support amongst these people. And so these are the five facts, okay? One, Jesus died by crucifixion. Two, very shortly after Jesus' death, the disciples had experiences that led them to believe and proclaim that Jesus had been resurrected and had appeared to them. Three, within a few years after Jesus' death, Saul, who persecuted Christians, converted and became Paul, after experiencing what he interpreted as a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus to him. Four, not too long after Jesus' death, James, the brother of Jesus, who was a skeptic, converted after experiencing what he interpreted as a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus to him. And five, and this is the one that has 75% support. The tomb was empty the third day after Jesus' death. Now, any explanation that is put forth to account for Christianity, to account for the resurrection of Jesus' claims, any explanation somebody has to put forth has to explain all of these things. And it has to do it consistently, and it has to do it non-arbitrarily. That is, they have to be able to prove what they're saying also. And that is how well they are supported historically. If you can't account for these facts, then you don't have an explanation. You have an excuse. Failure to account for any one fact out of this group shows that it most likely can't be true. Now, I am limited by how long I can keep your attention in the podcast episode. There are a number of theories that have been put forth to explain the resurrection claim of Jesus Christ. And so I may do a more in-depth episode on arguments against the resurrection of Jesus in the near future if somebody requests. But I'm going to limit myself to just a few in this episode for the reason that these ones are more common. Let's talk about the legend theory. If you go to college and watch the Discovery Channel, these ones are put forth a lot, the legend theories. And there's two forms of it. There are actually three forms of it. There's the embellishment, the non-historical genre, and myths. Those are three forms of it in other religions. So we'll talk about the embellishment and myths in other religions now because I've heard them more commonly used. So let's talk about the legend theory, embellishment. If you've ever heard a professor or a teacher use the telephone analogy about how the gospel story grew over time, when they say, oh, it was like the game Telephone. Didn't you play that whenever you were little? They would usually appeal to it like saying literally something like this. We all know what it's like to hear how far our grandfather walked in the snow to school, and every time it gets farther. Or even, we all understand how the telephone game works. If that much distortion could happen in 5 minutes, how much would happen in hundreds of years? And that's the embellishment theory. And it sounds really smart in a classroom setting where there was a lot of peer pressure to keep quiet, but it's a terrible explanation. It's not even logical. For one, even critical scholars question very few words in the New Testament. Most people don't know that. So whatever legend embellishment creeped in, it had to do it before the New Testament was written, which was quite quick. Here are some things to consider, though, about this. The resurrection story itself can be traced back to the real experiences of the original apostles right out of the gate, 50 days after the death of Jesus. They were preaching the bodily resurrection of Jesus, and we have support for that. The church persecutor Paul was converted through a personal experience that he had apart from what was being preached by the early church. He was converted very early, 1 to 3 years after Jesus' death. His hostility to the resurrection claim of early Christians makes it highly unlikely that he would have been persuaded by a simple fable. Next, this also applies to the skeptic James, his half-brother. He had an experience that he believed to be the risen Jesus, which led to his conversion apart from any story that he heard. And it also doesn't account for why the tomb was empty. If it was just embellishment, then the body would still have been in the tomb. So merely asserting something is not proving it. The resurrection claim has facts that back it up. Any other theory put forth has to have evidence too, otherwise it's just arbitrary. And it's being made up to deny a conclusion without accounting for the evidence that leads to it. You may want to deny the resurrection of Jesus, but you have to account for the evidence. And also, there's a number of problems with the whole quote-unquote embellishment theory. One, it treats the text of the Bible as though it's any other book, which it means it comes to the table denying God's existence, which shows the bias for one thing. And two, the telephone game does not rely on written accounts, does it? It relies on oral things, doesn't it? And it's usually done by children, not grown adults. Okay, the next one I want to look at real quick is the legend theory, myths in other religions. Now, this theory says that the disciples merely copied from other religions, which also had claims of resurrection. Skeptics will often cite Osiris, Tammuz, Adonis, Attis, and Marduk as examples of resurrection claims in other religions. and there are some notable problems with this theory. For one thing, many of the accounts in these other religions are very unclear. You end up not being very sure about whether or not it is claiming a resurrection at all. They're often vague and don't resemble the story of Christ's resurrection at all. They either rose to heaven on the horse Pegasus, or their names are declared among the stars. The majority of critical scholars today say that these myths in other religions didn't do what skeptics claim. Remember, there is a difference between a scholar who knows the data and a skeptic who just denies things. Next, the first actual account of a dying and rising God that somewhat parallels the story of Jesus is at least 100 years after the death of Jesus, and the earliest being Adonis. And even in the earliest writings about Adonis, there is no death and resurrection. It was added later. Now contrast this with the fact that the death and resurrection of Jesus was being publicly preached 50 days after his public death and burial. And there is not a clear death and resurrection of Marduk. There are conflicting stories about what happened to Osiris. In fact, there are actually no accounts that claim Osiris rose from the dead. The tale of Osiris actually predates Christianity, but it is more a story of becoming a zombie than a resurrection. It's also notable that Osiris is not even the hero of the story. Secondly, these other accounts in other religions lack any evidence and are easily explainable. Even Islamic scholars regard the tales of miracles done by Muhammad as untrustworthy because they didn't appear until 75 years after his death. Contrast this with the stories of Jesus' miracles, which were widely known while he was alive, and even his enemies have recorded it. These parallel accounts, quote-unquote, consist of long-time past events that didn't circulate when eyewitnesses could be examined. Thirdly, this still doesn't account for any of the evidence that we have. Jesus died by crucifixion. The disciples sincerely believed and proclaimed his resurrection. Paul, who was hostile, was converted based on a personal experience. James, who was skeptical, was converted based on a personal experience, not to mention the tomb was actually empty. This argument actually doesn't explain anything. Now, you get the idea of how the facts work. Does this theory actually explain the evidence? That's a question you should ask. Is there actual evidence that this theory is true? Is it just made up to deny the resurrection without dealing with the evidence? That's a question you should constantly ask. And we can go through a whole lot more. The disciples stole the body. Well, then why did Paul convert separately from them by a personal experience? Why was James converted separately by a personal experience? Why would they die for what they knew to be a lie if all the evidence points to the fact that they sincerely believed it? Oh, it was just a hallucination. Well, even if we were to grant the first mass hallucination ever recorded, which is contrary to the definition of a hallucination, then how does this account for the evidence? The tomb was empty. Paul was converted separate from the disciples and later, and was unsympathetic to their cause. James was converted separate and later, and was unsympathetic to their cause. Also, there was no evidence that it was a hallucination. Someone else stole the body. Well, why was Paul converted then by a personal experience? You see how we keep bringing these things up. They have to explain them. Why was James converted? By a personal experience. Also, the disciples didn't believe based on an empty tomb. If somebody else stole the body, the tomb was empty, but the disciples didn't believe when they saw the empty tomb. That's recorded in the Gospels. They believed when they professed to have seen and touched Jesus' resurrected body. Also, there was no evidence that somebody else stole the body. they just went to the wrong tomb. Well, even if this were true, the appearances to the disciples need to be accounted for. They were converted after professing to see Jesus and touch him, not from an empty tomb. Paul was not convinced by an empty tomb, but was converted based on a personal experience, though he was unsympathetic to the Christian cause. That goes for James as well. There is also no source that says that they went to the wrong tomb. No source. Also, the text records that it was the rich man Joseph of Arimathea whose tomb he was buried in. This indicates that the location was known. Certainly, the guards who were guarding it would have known where he was. Oh, this is one of my favorites. He didn't actually die. This is the swoon theory. Now, the Journal of the American Medical Association, March 21st, 1986, says this is impossible given the pathological effects of Jesus' scourging and crucifixion. I want you to think about that. The Journal of the American Medical Association, March 21st, 1986, says this wound theory is impossible. Now, are you honestly going to tell me that given Jesus' scourging, which historically exposed bones, veins, and internal organs at times, and crucifixion, in which he was nailed through his hands and feet to a cross and stabbed in the side by a spear, that he pushed the stone away from the door by himself, beat up the guards who were trained Roman soldiers that were watching his tomb by himself, walked the miles to where his disciples were hiding because somehow he knew where they were, and appeared in this state and proclaimed himself the Prince of Life? This contradicts what Paul saw also. Paul records a glorious appearance of the risen Jesus. No serious scholar actually holds to the swoon theory. None. Oh, this is the last one that I'm going to mention. Oh, they were just delusional. Well, that doesn't explain the empty tomb. It also doesn't explain the conversion of Paul, who was unsympathetic to the Christians and thought that Jesus got what he deserved. The same goes for James, who thought that Jesus was a false prophet who got what he deserved. There is literally no other theory that can account for the data. And this leaves us with one conclusion: the strength of the historical facts plus the failure of these alternative naturalistic theories to account for the data leads us to conclude that the resurrection of Jesus must be taken as a historical event.
Thank you for listening to Remnant Bible Fellowship. We do hope and pray that you would commit your life to Christ and continue in Him. We desire to see people seeking Jesus Christ and coming to know Him personally. If you have questions about salvation, the Bible, or your own walk with Christ, please contact Brother Jonathan by email. Brother John, that's J-O-N, at remnantbiblefellowship.com. That's Brother John at remnantbiblefellowship.com.